The following is a production of Vanderbilt's Owen Graduate School of Management. For more information about Owen, please visit owen.vanderbilt.edu.
Okay, so our format today is actually simply going to be question and answers. We're going to try and tease the truth out of Yvonne, which, since I've seen him speak, isn't going to be very hard. I'm going to start with several questions. And this is not like quiz show. We haven't given him the answers. But I'd also like to invite you all to come. There are four microphones. There are two here, and I believe there are two up top. So please feel free to come forward. And Yvonne has said that really he's tired of hearing me. He'd rather hear from you. So, and I second that. So please feel free to come up to the microphone as soon as the spirit moves you. Yvonne, first question, which I think is only fair. Is there anything in my opening remarks, assuming you were listening to them, that you want to avow or disaffirm or reject?
No, I don't think so.
That's our entire presentation. Thank you very much.
You did your homework.
Okay, well, let me ask you this. Tell us about some of the joys and frustrations of starting and running a business like Patagonia. And what has been some of the great achievements, and what have been some of your frustrations?
Oh, that's a real general question. I've never wanted to be a businessman, for one thing. I was a kind of a craftsman who just happened to make products that people wanted, so I never respected the profession.
No offense intended.
So, you know, in the early days, I grew it kind of organically. But in 1989, we kind of hit the wall. We had been growing 50% a year, and I was deeply in debt to the banks. And then the country went into a recession, and we only grew 30% that year. But we were so on the edge that it made a huge difference. We had bought all the inventory and hired people and I almost lost the business. And I was, in fact, I had an accountant who was trying to introduce me to the mafia who was gonna lend me some money. And they wanted 28% interest, which is ironically what your credit card charges you now.
I'm aware of this.
So it was a horrible time. I mean, couldn't sleep. My wife and I were just miserable, and we realized that we were making all the same mistakes that a lot of businesses make, which is just going for the growth. And we had to question why we're in business, and so that brought in a lot of soul searching, and basically, I had to get all my management together, and we went on a walkabout down in the real Patagonia down south, and we had to ask ourselves, why are we in business? Because none of us in the company had any business background, and they were all had degrees in anthropology and biology, and I had a high school degree in auto mechanics. So we had to ask ourselves, what are we doing anyway? Why are we in business? And so we had to sit down and write our values. And our values were, we wanted to make the best product in the world. This is when I had, mostly making climbing equipment and some clothing. And we wanted to make products for ourselves. And we took great pride in making the best product. So, okay, that'll be our mission statement, make the best product. We're also concerned about the environment, so we added a second part to the mission statement, which is cause no unnecessary harm. And we wanted to work with friends. We wanted to be surrounded by friends. And we wanted to blur the distinction between work and family and our sports. Just kind of blur it. So we wanted to be with our kids at work, and we wanted to make product that we would on weekends or whatever, go out and use. And we wanted to have free time. We were really individualistic people, and we didn't want anybody telling us what to do, and we didn't want to go to work 9 to 5. So we had to have flex time. And then we also realized that if you're going to have the best business or the best, make the best product, you can't be the biggest company. It's, you know, it's kind of like if you're a little restaurant in France and you spend 10 years getting that first Michelin star, and then another 10 years getting the second, and another 10 years getting the third Michelin star, and you're one of the 50 best restaurants in the world. And you say, okay, we made it, so now let's put in, you know, 50 tables. There are no three-star restaurants with 50 tables. There just aren't. You can't control the quality with that size of a restaurant. And in fact, in Japan, if you go to the very best restaurants in Japan, they're tiny little things. And it costs you, you know, $450, $500 for a meal. And the size is dictated by the fact that, number one, the chef is the owner, because he has the passion to really make that great food. And the chef has to see all the customers. So while he's cooking, he has to see the customers. So it's limited by the size. So I've always believed that there's a proper size for every endeavor. And so then we said, okay, if this is what we want to do, then we have to control our growth. We can't be like every other company and just keep expanding. So that was a changeabout in the whole company. And since then, we've been growing what we call organically. So it's, you know, we hardly advertise. We don't pay for billboards in inner cities or on buses so that the gang kids wear our black down jackets instead of North Faces. So when the customers are frustrated with us, when they say, oh, I just got your catalog, I just ordered something and you're already out of it, then we make more. That's how we grow. So we let the customer tell us how quickly we should grow.
Have you ever felt that the company's gotten too big? I mean, you've gone from a small company to now almost $300 million in sales, operating in many countries, 50 stores around the world.
It's actually too small right now.
Too small.
We've been growing 3 to 5% the last few years, and our customers are frustrated. And so we need, you know, when you learn to ski, the curve of how you learn is not a steady like this. You take a lesson and you go up like that, and then you're going like this for a long time, and then you take another lesson or you hit another plateau and you go like that. And that's the way we grow. We grow like this and all of a sudden like that. Whereas, you know, public companies, they grow 15% every year and it's like this. And it makes no sense, because that's what happens when you have a yearly budget. But I think a yearly budget is a disaster. For one thing, I'm trying to run my company as if it's going to be here 100 years from now. So it could very well be that for 2 or 3 years, we have very little growth and small profits, but we're investing into the future. It's a different way of running the business than, say, a public company. And if you grow like this, 15% a year, it doesn't take very long before you go bankrupt. Because you've outgrown your market, you've outgrown your whole idea of your business. There's a proper size for every endeavor, I think, including business.
One of the things I was curious in hearing about your, you know, you call yourself a reluctant businessman, but do you now look back and consider yourself sort of a social entrepreneur? And how do you feel about the idea that companies can be created that do more than just make a profit?
Well, you know, we consider that our stockholders is the planet. It's a kind of a different way of looking at it. The planet basically tells us what to do. That's who we answer to. I've got all the money I ever need for the rest of my life. I've got a pretty simple life. I'm not a consumer at all. So I don't hang out with other businessmen. I don't need the power and the prestige of being a big shot businessman. So I'm in business for different reasons, and I'm very pessimistic about the fate of the society and the planet, and I don't get depressed about it because the cure for depression is action. So as long as I feel like I'm doing something, and for me, my biggest resource is this company. So I'm using the company to effect change.
And Prozac is also excellent. But I'm curious about this because I found this out about you when we were talking this morning. I was surprised that you were a pessimist about things because you're obviously a real change agent. And I think most of the people in this room feel that you and your company have tried to strike a hopeful note. So how do you reconcile that sort of over pessimism with sort of what you've done in your life?
Well, I mean, if you look at, you know, populations going like this, our consumption of goods is going like this, and our natural resources are going like this. It doesn't take a genius to see that it's unsustainable. And you know what? It's not going to change. It's, you know, I have so many friends that I've gone to see Inconvenient Truth, or they saw Tom Brokaw's thing on Discovery Channel on global warming. Very few of them have changed their light bulbs. I don't see any reason for optimism. It's the whole economy is based on consuming and discarding. And all it takes is one little incident in the world to destroy that whole economy. I mean, look at 9/11. You know, it took the president to get up there and tell everybody to go shopping again. We're addicted to petroleum, and we're running out of petroleum. And our attitude is to guarantee the supply of petroleum instead of admitting that we're addicts and saying we've got to stop using petroleum. I don't see any change in society that's... And I've traveled around, you know, I've climbed on every continent. I've been to Africa, I don't know how many times. Every time I go back, I see deterioration. But yet, I'm a happy man. And it's kind of, you know, I've been a student of Zen philosophy a lot in my life. You know, I believe that profits happen. Not when you focus on making profits, but when you do everything right. I learned a long time ago climbing in Yosemite that the goal is not the summit, because you get to the top of a route in Yosemite and it's just flat up there. There's nothing there. The goal is in how you climb the route, is the process. And for me, what keeps me going is knowing that I'm doing what I can in my own way and with my own resources to solve a lot of these problems. And so, you know, as long as you're active, it's kind of like if you lived in Nazi Germany during World War II and you didn't speak out, you didn't do anything, you're left, you know, either with a lot of guilt or you actually lost your soul. And but as long as you're active, you know, without becoming a martyr, of course, it works out.
We have some questions from the audience, so.
I mean, just pick up a copy of Rolling Stone this week. There's an article in there about James Lovelock, who came up with the Gaia Theory. If you want to see a gloomy article, he thinks by 2100, there'll be 500,000 people left on Earth. So that's
by 2500?
2100.
Well, I won't be one of them. Go ahead.
Testing, testing. My name is Jeff Berry, and I created the film Kilowatt Hours, which was screened at your headquarters a year and a half ago or so. And it's showing the new addition to my film is screening tomorrow at 1:45 at Surratt Cinema as part of the conference here. And, of course, I'm going to share it with y'all. I am an optimist, and I do this work. I have an NGO in town called Kilowatt Hours, and we're teaching individuals how to change their light bulbs and do a whole host of other things in their homes. And so I'm fueled by optimism that it's just a matter of talking to enough people. But the thing I'm curious about today is, from what you said and what I heard about your company, is the blurring that line between friends and family and the workplace. And I've read a lot where you never hire your friends because it just creates a lot of headache later. And this is a nuts and bolts question, but what challenges have you faced working with friends and family, and how have you overcome those?
Well, that's a good question. Actually, you hire friends, but you don't manage them directly. That's a disaster. Let somebody else manage them. And, you know, actually, we've had a psychologist look at our employees and what they're like, and he said, you know, I got to tell you that you've got the most independent people I've ever seen in any company. They're so independent that they're unemployable in another company. And so the challenge is to get all those independent people all moving together. And you can't do it by ordering them around. You have to build consensus. Otherwise, you get a passive-aggressive response, and nothing happens. And so that's the key to management at Patagonia. And that's why my book is called Let My People Go Surfing, because when I'm gone, and I'm gone a lot of the times, I never call into the company, never. I don't need to know that if I don't call in, everything's going to fall apart. So I leave people alone who are competent. First of all, hire the most competent people. Hire people you want to go to dinner with, and then leave them alone. Let them do their work. My job is to be on the outside and bring ideas into the company and kind of bring in radical ideas. Some of them are pretty stupid, and some of them are pretty good. And then I present those ideas, and nothing happens, though, unless we build a consensus.
I wanted to follow up on that. A number of years ago, when the company did have an economic downturn, you were forced to lay off, I think, 20% of the company.
Yeah.
You said it was one of the hardest days of your life, I think. But how do you reconcile trying to have a humanistic company of the kind you've had with some of the hard choices that CEOs and business people have to make?
Well, that was the last time we've had to lay anybody off like that. And I never want it to happen again. So that's why we control our growth. If you look at public companies, they grow like crazy, and then all of a sudden they lay off 5,000 people. You know, and because they're in business strictly to maximize profits for the shareholders. That's the way all decisions are made. Like I said, our shareholder is the planet. And it's a different way of running the company.
Hi, I'm Jason Packer. I'm with American University. And I have a quick question for you about R&D. Do you get involved in that? I mean, you've been involved in, you were involved in the beginning, obviously. And are you involved in it now? How long does it take to get, like, a jacket, you know, created? And then that's my first part of the question. The second part is, are you outsourcing a lot of this stuff to places like China? And if you are, I mean, do you have concerns about human rights issues and quality, obviously, issues? Or do you think it's important to keep it in this, you know, under your purview within whatever, how many miles within your corporate headquarters? I don't really know how you guys do that, so I'm just curious. Okay.
Well, yeah, I'm still personally involved in some of the R&D. I've been involved, like right now we're coming out with a wetsuit, and I've been involved with that quite a bit. First of all, it takes 18 months to get a product to market from the time we start, generally. That wetsuit's taken us 3 years, or 4 years almost. Because we don't just start with a fabric or something, you know. Most companies in the fashion business, you just call a fabric supplier and say, hey, bring over some shirting fabric, and you sit there with these books on fabrics, and you say, okay, give me 10,000 yards of this in this print, and, you know, that's the way it's done. We develop our own fabrics and stuff, and we have a whole environmental assessment process that constantly asks questions. In other words, we're trying to lead an examined life in business. And so, you know, we have to minimize the damage in our product. So that means a fabric supplier comes by and says, hey, I got this new bamboo fabric. Great stuff, you know, it's made out all sustainable, it's made out of bamboo, and bamboo grows 5 feet, you know, a week, and blah, blah, blah. Well, we have to take it deeper than that. We have to find out, okay, is this bamboo really sustainable? Is it a good fiber? So we have a huge lab that tests all of this, but the other thing is we have to ask questions. And then we find out that in the process of making bamboo fiber, it's like rayon, which uses a lot of really bad chemicals. Corn, I mean, they're making clothing out of corn, it's PLA. Corn is the most unsustainable crop in America. It destroys a bushel of topsoil, over a bushel of topsoil, for every bushel of corn that's grown. And it's fed with fossil water that's millions of years old, that's not being replenished. You know, the Ogallala Aquifer underneath the Midwest used to be 30 feet underground, now it's 300. And it uses genetically modified corn. It's a stupid thing to be making clothing out of. So we have to, if you want to feed your family healthy food, you can't just go to the supermarket, is what I'm saying. You have to know where the food comes from. You have to know the farmer, or you got to really ask a lot of questions. You got to look at the ingredient lists and those Twinkies. You know, if you're drinking Coca-Cola, you got to realize that high fructose corn syrup is one of the major causes of diabetes in America. So leading an examined life in business is a real pain in the ass. It really is. It really lengthens the development time. But you're left with no guilt either.
Hi. Is this thing on?
Oh, and yeah, we do make things in China. We make things all over the world. The reason we make things in China is not because it's cheaper. I mean, that's the reason Walmart is in China, is because of the price. We're in China because China produces the best quality sewing in the world. Bar none. And all the shells that we're making that have no sewing, that all glued and everything, are all coming out of China. China has invested into the best machinery in the world. They have the best workmanship, and that's why we're in China. But we're not in sweatshops. We're not in those factories that are making things for Costco and stuff. We're in factories where you can eat off the floor, and it's the exact opposite of a sweatshop.
I'm Bill Noto from UMass Amherst, and I just want to say first, up here. I just want to say thanks very much for coming, to both of you. And also, a comment. My sense of Patagonia and other companies sort of like it, like Clif Bar, that are private, you know, where the you get the sense that the company's values are really the founder's values, and they've been able to retain those values because they've been kept private. So my question is, what do you do to plan for the next generation? How do you make sure that after you're gone, you know, maybe 20 years from now or whatever, they don't... maybe 50 years. they don't sell the company or, you know, change their values.
That's a good question, and it's an impossible question to answer.
Next question. No, go ahead.
I mean, that's basically why I wrote my book, is for my own employees, as a guideline, as a philosophy of business. And the problem is all the tax laws in America basically force you to become a public company or force you to sell out, because the law says that if after my wife and I die, actually the stock is owned by a family trust, and after we die, the stock goes into a family foundation, environmental foundation. So the foundation has to divest itself of 80% of the stock within a maximum of 14 years. So it forces you to sell out. And in fact, the people at Clif Bar are really good friends of mine, and I'm meeting with them in a couple weeks, with them and Fritz Maytag of Anchor Brewing, Anchor Beer, and we're talking about this very thing. How do we keep the company going with the same values and stuff after we're gone? It's a tough one. I don't really know.
Let's see, I want to get to that. Hi, Susanna Schick from University of North Carolina. Andy said that you have been very active in voter initiatives on environmentalism. So I'm curious what you think we can do to get voters to recognize the importance of ending U.S. cotton subsidies, particularly given the comparative advantage that developing world cotton farmers have when it comes to organic cotton.
Well, I'd like to get rid of all subsidies. I mean, that, one of the reasons why we can't recycle more goods is that it's still cheaper to be making everything out of virgin petroleum and virgin materials, and it's all because of subsidies. I mean, you can imagine what the subsidies for petroleum are. I mean, you know, everybody freaked out that the price of petroleum is $94 a barrel. If petroleum was bottled water, it would be $6,000 a barrel. And nobody complains about bottled water. It's ridiculous how cheap it is. You know, I don't know how to lobby against it. I mean, this farm bill that's coming up is the stupidest thing I've ever heard of. It doesn't get to the small farmer. It doesn't get to the small organic farmer who's trying to do things right. It all goes to the gigantic distribution companies. There's no fairness in this society. And you know, I've kind of given up on government, that it's going to solve our problem. How many of you think the government's going to solve our problems? We got one hand. You know, corporations, do we trust corporations to self-regulate? And no. How about our religious leaders? I mean, are they going to lead us out of this mess? You know, the ones that aren't in jail, that is. It's up to us. We're the ones, you know. We have the government we deserve. You know, the government is a reflection of who we are right now. We're a nation that only 50% of us believe in evolution. And we've got it. And the next, you know, I look at the presidential candidates. The environment is number 5 on the list of priorities. And I mean, every single day practically in the newspapers is a gloomier and gloomier forecast for global warming. And that's just global warming. That's not the fact that we're running out of water, we're running out of topsoil, we're running out of petroleum, we're running out of all these natural resources, and yet the environment is number 5. So society is, and all these politicians are only dealing with symptoms. They only want to deal with symptoms. They don't want to deal with real causes. It's kind of like, you know, one out of eight of you women in this room are going to get breast cancer. And yet only 3% of the monies that go to breast cancer research go to trying to find the environmental causes. And I can tell you, it's not all genetics. And they're finally starting, I just saw in the paper yesterday, they're finally starting to realize that we're killing ourselves with how we eat and all the chemicals that we're ingesting. But, you know, there's no money to be made in finding causes. The money is to be made in finding cures. And, you know, the makeup of the Cancer Society is all CEOs of pharmaceutical companies. So I can't see that any of our government leaders are really going to be focusing on causes. I mean, why are we in Iraq? Duh, it's the oil. They're sitting on the biggest oil reserves left in the world. Why are we building a $1 billion embassy in Iraq? It's the oil. And yet nobody talks about the oil. We're there to free the Iraqis, to turn them into consumers. And it's crazy. But I can tell you, we can't do it without government. And that's why, you know, I can't tell you who to vote for. In fact, I don't even know who to vote for. Legally, I can't do that, but all we...
give it a shot.
Well, I don't really know. I don't hear anybody talking about the real problems. But we tell people, look, just vote for the environment. If you look at the League of Conservation Voters, and they give a score to all our politicians, all the ones in the lower 10% that vote only, you know, less than 10%, they've all been indicted. All of them. They're all crooks. There's a direct relationship on how somebody votes for the environment and how honest they are.
I agree with that. Geez, Yvonne, I just wish you'd actually tell us what's on your mind. How do we get real honesty? Let's see. Yes.
Hi, I'm Courtney from UNC. I had a question about a lot of companies look at risk management, and when they're not at the point that you're at in terms of looking towards social responsibility. So I was wondering what Patagonia's biggest risk is. And secondly, seeing how tall you are, I was wondering when Patagonia is going to start making clothes for short people.
You just got to hem them, that's all. That's what I do. Well, we don't have any risk management. We're proactive. I believe that a company has a responsibility for the product that it makes and how it makes the product. Let's say you have, you're one of the best companies in America. You have unbelievable benefits for your employees. You make the best product among all your competitors, and you're a great company. But you're making landmines. You're making great landmines. And then you go to Cambodia and you see all these people walking around with one leg, and you think, oh man. But you know what? You're waiting for the customer to tell you to stop making landmines. That's what General Motors and Ford is doing. They're going to stop making SUVs when you tell them to stop making SUVs. Pepsi-Cola and Coca-Cola are going to get rid of the high-fructose corn syrup when you tell them. But that's wrong. I think, you know, leading an examined life and business, you realize all the things that you had no idea you were doing are wrong, and you stop doing those. That's what leading an examined life is. I think most of the damage that we do to ourselves and to our planet are unintentional. They're just, you know, blundering along and, you know, not reading that label on Twinkies, basically, as a metaphor. So once you find out that you are doing something wrong, stop doing it. And, you know, that company making landmines shouldn't be making landmines, period. And we've seen what happens when you don't do that. I mean, Toyota's laughing all the way to the bank. And General Motors and Ford, I've watched them, you know, resist seatbelts. They've resisted airbags. They're resisting fuel standards. They're going to resist all the way to bankruptcy court.
Part of the trick of being sustainable is to turn responsibility into opportunity. And, you know, while the American car companies were resisting safety, Volvo said, we're going to sell this and make money at it. And they've become a hugely successful car company on the basis of safety. So,
yeah, I mean, would you rather own stock in Safeway and Albertsons or Whole Foods? It's very simple. The tremendous opportunity in this economy right now to be doing the right thing.
Now, there's some optimism. I knew we could get it out of you. Yes, please.
Hi, my name is Kristen. I'm a student at the Cornell Johnson School and the Fletcher School at Tufts. And my question is about your recycling program with your Capilene long underwear. From what I understand, you actually encourage consumers to not return it to Patagonia until it's completely used up and has holes, et cetera. And my question is, do you ever find any tension within your company between encouraging consumers to hold on to your product as long as possible and selling more of the product? And I was also wondering if you could comment on your relationship with Walmart and the influence you've had on encouraging them to go with organic cotton. Thanks.
Those are good questions. You know, when I say a company has responsibility for how it makes the product and for the product, we're saying to ourselves that we have responsibility for the product from birth till birth. So like a computer company, you know, sells you a computer and then that's the end of their responsibility. They don't feel a responsibility to give you any service or to take the thing back. And we're saying, okay, by 2010, we've made a goal for ourselves to make all our clothing out of recycled and recyclable fibers. So it's pretty limiting because polyester can be recycled kind of indefinitely and infinitely. And nylon 6, which is one of the types of nylon. So we're switching all our products to polyester, nylon 6, cotton, wool, and hemp. And we're starting with polyester, where when you're done with a polyester product from Patagonia, give it back to us. We bundle it up. We put it on a ship back to Japan, and those ships are empty. So we get unbelievable shipping rates. And it goes back to a factory in Japan, and it gets melted down into its original polymer. And they take out the antimony, which is in, you know, when you're drinking these soda pop bottles, that polyester bottle has antimony, which is a toxic metal. They're able to take that out. They recycle all polyester, and then they make more fiber out of it. And we're going to do that with polyester. We're going to do that with nylon 6. We're going to be making, doing it with cotton. We're going to come out with a line of t-shirts that's all kind of heather color, because it's cotton comes in every color, and we're not going to bleach it. Sweatshirts, we're recycling wool. And so we're accepting responsibility for that product from birth till birth again. So we're going to close the cycle, because the idea of consuming and discarding is, we got to get rid of that idea. That's absolutely an old idea, because the resources are just going down. What was that other question again?
Walmart.
Oh, Walmart. Well, Walmart's not the only. We're inundated with companies that want to come out to California and visit our company, because there's a revolution going on in business. There really is. It's not just Walmart, but so many businessmen are freaked out. I mean, that's why, you know, these doomsday religions are so popular right now. Deep down inside, a lot of people know that it's all over. Well, and some of them want to do something. And so I've got businessmen calling me from across the country and say, hey, I want to fly out in my Gulfstream and talk to you guys. And because they want to see whether we're a green, just green marketing, or if we're real. You know, we've been in it for a long time. And so my company exists basically to take those risks that they want to take. But they want to know that it's profitable to do that and it's the right thing. And so, you know, I had 7 executives from Walmart come visit us. And I tell all these people the same thing. I ask them, look, how far do you want to take it? Do you want to just green your parking lots and your buildings, or do you want to change the world? Do you want to take it to your suppliers and your suppliers' suppliers? How far do you want to take it? And they've never thought about that. You know, how far do you really go? And I gave a talk to a bunch of filmmakers, wildlife filmmakers. I said the same thing. What do you want to do in your wildlife films? Do you want to just entertain people? Or do you want to change the world? So that's the question I ask. And you can ask yourself that. What do you want to do in your business? You just want to make a bunch of money? You want to make a so-so product? Or do you want to change the world?
I'm Lindsay. I work for Rare. And we're based in Arlington. We're a conservation group. And on behalf of all of us at Rare, we are grant recipients of Patagonia, so thank you. My question has to do with the 1% for the Planet program.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the origin of that program and what you do with it today. Because I'm curious about what partnerships, if any, Patagonia takes on with other retail groups and with other companies like Walmart. I mean, you've already touched on it a little bit, but if you could just elaborate on that particular program, it would be great.
Well, what we do is take 1% of our sales, and we use that to support civil democracy, basically, and specifically in environmental causes. And I started an organization a few years ago called 1% for the Planet. And it's an alliance of like-minded companies that are all doing the same thing. So what happens is that you make out the checks. It's as if next time you get your income tax form, on the back, you get to say where the money goes. You know, you say, okay, I want 5% to go to the military. I want 10% for health and welfare. It's called taxation with representation. But it'll never happen. But it will happen. I believe in taxes. I'm a firm believer in taxes. I think we should have resource taxes instead of income tax. Tax consuming. But anyway, if I really believe that, then I'm going to tax myself right now. And that's what our 1% is. It's a self-tax. And each company makes out their own checks to whatever organization they want, as long as it's an environmental organization. And then there's a fee for belonging to 1% for the planet. And right now we have probably 770 companies that have joined. We're signing up over one a day now. The more people that sign up, the more people want to sign up. And last week, one of the best companies in America, New Belgian Brewing, they make Fat Tire Ale. Ah, I thought that would get a response from this crowd. So they just joined. And Cliff Bar is getting real close. Keen Shoes is going to join. These are all small little companies, no public companies. They're small little barbershops, yoga studios. These are people where it really hurts to take 1% of your sales. I mean, you may not have made a profit. The reason we went from 10% of our profits before taxes to 1% of our sales is that we found too many companies were saying the same thing we were. Oh yeah, well, we take 10% of our profits and give it away. Well, all it takes is to make no profit, and you can say that. Or you can give a big bonus to all the top management and make, you know, $10 profit and give, you know, that's 1 cent away. So 1% of sales keeps you absolutely honest. You can't fake that. And it's, whether you make a profit or not, the problems are not going away. And so these are serious little companies that are doing this. And yeah, we do, well, we have Honest Tea, which is a member, and we serve that in our cafeteria. In Jackson Hole, Wyoming, I've been involved in starting an organization called 1% for the Tetons. The people in Jackson Hole are surrounded by this great wilderness, and they accepted the fact that they have more responsibility than the average taxpayer to preserve that wilderness. Their lives are dependent on it, their livelihoods. And so they started a 1% for the Tetons, and so these little businesses, there's 60 businesses belong in a town of 12,000 permanent population. And I can tell you that it's helped their businesses tremendously. A little bagel shop belongs. Everybody, boom, went over and bought their bagels from there. There's a market that's competing with Smith's and Albertsons, two big supermarkets in town. And they're a kind of a small little Whole Foods type market. Their business just shot up like crazy. Everybody's buying there. They have a big 1% for the planet logo on the front door. So in a small town, it really works. I think a lot of members are, I mean, we have law firms that belong. If I was looking for a law firm, I'd look in the list of 1% members, and that's who I'd pick. So it's we're doing business with each other, and it's a quiet revolution. And the public companies will start joining, and the larger companies will start joining when they can see that it's a marketing advantage to have that 1% logo. That'll happen someday. I mean, imagine if a gasoline company, every time you went to buy gasoline, on your receipt, it said, thank you for your buying. You know, 20 cents is going to go to restoring the natural world or creating a new national park. I mean, I would go out of my way to buy that gasoline. Right now, I have no reason to buy anyone's gasoline. It's all the same.
Sure.
Good morning. My name is Neil Wasserman. I'm one of those business professionals who's hoping to learn something from the huge array of creative energy in the student population in this room. I found your initial opening pessimism very refreshing. Because I, as I listen to the optimists, I hear them talking about no end to oil and don't worry about the 450 parts per million of CO2 equivalent in the atmosphere. And, so the optimists send shivers up my spine. But I just want to get your insight on how we might move forward in spreading this creative pessimism. If you listen to the behavioral economists, they demonstrate quite convincingly that there's this enormous bias towards the short term and the human psychology. But what's preventing us from taking important action is understanding the long-term consequences of what we do. Then if you listen to the social psychologists and anthropologists, human societies actually do care quite a bit about the long-term, and we have rituals and other behaviors that are quite long-term in focus. And what you've been giving us in terms of the generation of the growing community of which you're a part, there's a growing circle of folks who actually take the long-term consequences of their actions more seriously than the optimists who you show some disdain for. But I wanted to get your insight. How can we create those phase transitions and behaviors that can spread organically beyond the confines of a room like this one to create a normative change in how people act and take the future into account and give meaning to what they do in that way?
Well, you know, forget about trying to change the world. Change yourself. And I think every time I get stuck with a problem in business, the answer is always increase the quality. Always. You know, there's a reason why organic foods is growing, you know, 30% a year in America. It tastes better. It's better quality. And it's healthier for you. It's a win-win clear across the board. And I tell people, look, you know, instead of owning a pair of shorts to go play volleyball in, and then own another pair to go running in, and another pair to play basketball in, because it has a little basketball logo on it, and another pair to go hiking in, just buy one pair of shorts that does it all. And but buy the absolute best so that it never wears out. I mean, you know, that's one of the problems with our recycling program, is the stuff doesn't wear out. We're not getting very much back. But we will eventually. So that's the key, is quality. And the Europeans consume, you know, only 25% as much as we do. And they're sharp dressers, you know. They eat better food than we do. Quality is the key. Is just keep asking yourself, consume less, consume better.
Unfortunately, I'm afraid that we're out of time. Speaking for myself, I'll hang around for a little while for people who still have unanswered questions. I apologize to those of you who are standing at the microphones. I just want to close it with this, that many of you are in business, many of you are aspiring to be in business. I have dealt with many CEOs over my time and many business leaders, but we are in the presence today of true leadership. I mean, for all the laughs we've had, this is a man who I think, you know, remember this conversation, because this is a man, this is a person who I think is not only a great leader, and I think that's come through. I mean, I found myself saying, you know, I would follow him, but also somebody of great strength. And those are the kind of people I think we need to help us deal with these situations. I love the phrase creative pessimism. It's helped put...
You can work with that.
Yes, I'm actually going to steal it, as a matter of fact. Anyhow, I would like to thank Yvonne for what he's done and for being here with us today, and thank the audience for your kind attention.
Thank you. Great.